At first, all these European powers came merely as traders, and the only establishments they attempted were warehouses. But the unsettled state of the country and the unscrupulous methods of their rivals made it natural for them to fortify and arm their settlements, and this armament made them attractive allies of the various warring princes who now divided India. And it was entirely in the spirit of the new European nationalist politics that when the French took one side, the British should take another. The great leader upon the English side was Robert Clive, who was born in 1725 and went to India in 1743. His chief antagonist was Dupleix. The story of this struggle throughout the first half of the 18th century is too long and intricate to be told here. By 1761, the British found themselves completely dominant in the Indian peninsula. At Plassey in 1757 and Buxar in 1764, their armies gained striking and conclusive victories over the army of Bengal and the army of Oude. The great Mughal, nominally their overlord, became in effect their puppet. They levied taxes over great areas. They exacted indemnities for real or fancied opposition. These successes were not gained directly by the forces of the King of England. They were gained by the East India Trading Company, which had been originally, at the time of its incorporation under Queen Elizabeth, no more than a company of sea adventurers. Step by step, they had been forced to raise troops and arm their ships. And now this trading company, with its tradition of gain, found itself dealing not merely in spices and dyes and tea and jewels, but in the revenues and territories of princes and the destinies of India. It had come to buy and sell, and it found itself achieving a tremendous piracy. There was no one to challenge its proceedings. Is it any wonder that its captains and commanders and officials, nay, even its clerks and common soldiers, came back to England loaded with spoils? Men under such circumstances, with a great and wealthy land at their mercy, couldn't determine what they might or might not do. It was a strange land to them, with a strange sunlight. Its brown people were a different race, outside their range of sympathy. Its temples and buildings seemed to sustain fantastic standards of behaviour. Englishmen at home were perplexed when presently these generals and officials came back to make dark accusations against each other of extortions and cruelties. Upon Clive, Parliament passed a vote of censure. He committed suicide in 1774. In 1788, Warren Hastings, a second great Indian administrator, was impeached and acquitted, 1792. It was a strange and unprecedented situation in the world's history. The English Parliament found itself ruling over a London trading company, which in its turn was dominating an empire far greater and more populous than all the domains of the British Crown. To the bulk of the English people, India was a remote, fantastic, almost inaccessible land, to which adventurous poor young men went out to return after many years, very rich and very choleric old gentlemen. It was difficult for the English to conceive what the life of these countless brown millions in the eastern sunshine could be. Their imaginations declined the task. India remained romantically unreal. It was impossible for the English, therefore, to exert any effective supervision and control over the company's proceedings. 10th. And, while the great peninsula of the south of Asia was thus falling under the dominion of the English sea traders, an equally remarkable reaction of Europe upon Asia was going on in the north. We've told how the Christian states of Russia recovered their independence from the Golden Horde, and how the Tsar of Moscow became master of the Republic of Novgorod. And in the fifth part of this chapter, we've told of Peter the Great joining the circle of grand monarchs, and, as it were, dragging Russia into Europe. The rise of this great central power of the Old World, which is neither altogether of the East nor altogether of the West, is one of the utmost importance to our human destiny. We've also told in the same chapter of the appearance of a Christian steppe people, the Cossacks, who formed a barrier between the feudal agriculture of Poland and Hungary to the west and the Tatar to the east. The Cossacks were the wild east of Europe, and in many ways not unlike the wild west of the United States in the middle 19th century. All who had made Russia too hot to hold them, criminals as well as the persecuted innocent, rebellious serfs, religious sectaries, thieves, vagabonds, murderers, sought asylum in the southern steppes, and there made a fresh start and fought for life and freedom against Pole, Russian, and Tatar alike. Doubtless fugitives from the Tatars to the east also contributed to the Cossack mixture. Chief among these new nomad tribes were the Ukraine Cossacks on the Dnieper and the Don Cossacks on the Don. Slowly these border folk were incorporated in the Russian imperial service, such as the Highland clans of Scotland were converted into regiments by the British government. New lands were offered them in Asia. They became a weapon against the dwindling power of the Mongolian nomads, first in Turkestan, and then across Siberia as far as the Amur. The decay of Mongol energy in the 17th and 18th centuries is very difficult to explain. Within two or three centuries from the days of Genghis and Timurlane, Central Asia had relapsed from a period of world ascendancy to extreme political impotence. Changes of climate, unrecorded pestilences, infections of a malarial type may have played their part in this recession, which may be only a temporary recession measured by the scale of universal history of the Central Asian peoples. Some authorities think that the spread of Buddhist teaching from China also had a pacifying influence upon them. At any rate, by the 16th century, the Mongol, Tatar, and Turkish peoples were no longer pressing outward, but were being invaded, subjugated, and pushed back, both by Christian Russia in the west and by China in the east. All through the 17th century, the Cossacks were spreading eastward from European Russia and settling wherever they found agricultural conditions. Cordons of forts and stations formed a moving frontier to these settlements to the south, where the Turkomans were still strong and active. To the northeast, however, Russia had no frontier until she reached right to the Pacific. At the same time, China was in a phase of expansion. In 1644, the Ming dynasty, in a state of artistic decay and greatly weakened by a Japanese invasion, fell to Manchu conquerors, a people apparently identical with the former Qin dynasty, which had ruled at Peking over North China until the days of Genghis. It was the Manchus who imposed the pigtail as a mark of political loyalty upon the Chinese population. They brought a new energy into Chinese affairs, and their northern interests led to a considerable northward expansion of the Chinese civilization and influence into Manchuria and Mongolia. So it was that by the middle of the 18th century, the Russians and Chinese were in contact in Mongolia. At this period, China ruled eastern Turkestan, Tibet, Nepal, Burma, and Annam. We've mentioned a Japanese invasion of China, or rather of Korea. Except for this aggression upon China, Japan plays no part in our history before the 19th century. Like China under the Mings, Japan had set her face resolutely against the interference of foreigners in her affairs. She was a country leading her own civilized life, magically sealed against intruders. We've told little of her hitherto, because there was little to tell. Her picturesque and romantic history stands apart from the general drama of human affairs. Her population was chiefly a Mongolian population, with some very interesting white people of a Nordic type, the hairy Ainu, in the northern islands. Her civilization seems to have been derived almost entirely from Korea and China. Her art is a special development of Chinese art, her writing an adaptation of the Chinese script.